The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
The impeachment drum beats on in the Senate, with the Democrats building their point-by-point case against President Trump, including why they say the president lifted his hold on aid for Ukraine.
But it wasn't lifted for any legitimate reason. It was only lifted because President Trump had gotten caught.
Also, Italy's far-right message of getting tough on immigrants finds appeal in some traditionally left-wing strongholds.
We had to start to liberate this area from these Nigerians who were dealing drugs here illegally. This place was packed with drug dealers.
And the Grammy-nominated band Ranky Tanky stopped by our studio and demoed the African roots of Gullah music.
One, two, three, four, like this. Pain in my head, Ranky Tanky. Pain in my heart, Ranky Tanky.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. It is day four of the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump and the third and final day for the House managers, all Democrats, to make their opening arguments. Today, Representative Hakeem Jeffries was helping to build the case on the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress.
At the heart of Article 2, obstruction of Congress, is a simple, troubling reality. President Trump tried to cheat. He got caught. And then he worked hard to cover it up.
The jurors in the case, the senators, are mostly listening patiently. Here's Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, talking to reporters this morning.
I don't know about you, but it became mind-numbing after a while. I got the general point you're trying to make the fourth time you told me. So they're overtrying their case, and I would just urge them to not do that because eventually it gets just hard to follow.
President Trump echoed that sentiment in a tweet. The do-nothing Democrats, he wrote, just keep repeating and repeating over and over again the same old stuff on the impeachment hoax. Joining me now to review the events of the week are Jonathan Turley, one of the four constitutional scholars who testified to the House impeachment inquiry last month. He's also a professor at George Washington University. And Margaret Taylor, former chief counsel for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and now senior editor at Lawfare. Margaret, Jonathan, good to have you both with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So the week isn't over, but if we're going to identify the highlight, a lot of watchers are already saying it was the final speech on Thursday from Adam Schiff, the leader of the House managers, leading the case against Trump. Let's listen to just a moment from that.
If right doesn't matter, it doesn't matter how good the Constitution is. It doesn't matter how brilliant the framers were. Doesn't matter how good or bad our advocacy in this trial is. Doesn't matter how well written the oath of impartiality is. If right doesn't matter, we're lost. If the truth doesn't matter, we're lost.
Let's start at 35,000 feet and then we'll get into the details. What Congressman Schiff was saying there, Jonathan Turley, is this just rhetoric or is he on to something? Is democracy in America in peril here?
Well, the problem is that people are listening to the impeachment trial, and it's like a group of people listening to the same movie, but only hearing the lines they want to hear. The fact is that there are substantial questions left by the House because it rushed the impeachment vote and did not complete its record. When I testified, I said that the two articles that were approved were legitimate, if proven. But they then rushed a vote by Christmas, and they left a record that was insufficient to bring to the Senate. So they made it easy for the White House.
I mean, people will hear what they want to hear. Margaret Taylor, what do you think about what Congressman Schiff was saying?
I think he's right to clarify what the stakes are here. I think that he would disagree with Professor Turley about the case being made. I think they feel pretty comfortable that they have enough to make the case. They've been making it pretty methodically and systematically over the last 2.5 days now. So I think he's right to identify for Americans who are watching or tuning in here and there, you know, what are the stakes of the decision here. And so in that way, I don't think it's rhetoric. In terms of whether we're in peril, I mean, I'd probably at this point say no, because the system is working as it was constitutionally designed to work up until this point. I think the question going forward is, you know, do all the senators sort of credibly engage and legitimately engage with all the facts and make their decision based on that, or are they making their decision based on something else, for example, party affiliation with the president?
Well, Senator Graham was kind of warning about the presentation being too tedious, but he's also publicly complimented Adam Schiff for the team's presentation. Both of you are lawyers. You've both done high-profile presentations. Jonathan Turley, what do you make of the work done by the House managers this week?
Well, I think they've done a good job, a very good job. Adam Schiff was my opposing counsel in the last impeachment trial. I was representing the judge in that impeachment, and I found him to be a very able opposing counsel, surprisingly skilled for a member of Congress. They have had missteps. As the biggest one was when Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler basically accused the Senate, specifically the Republicans, of engaging in a cover-up. You know, there's a rule that we share with all of our law students that you can insult a lot of people in a courtroom, the prosecutor, the defense counsel, the defendant. You can never insult a jury. And the response was that Senator Collins, one of the four senators that the House is trying to get to vote for witnesses, sent a note to the Chief Justice leading to an admonishment of both sides. And then another one of those four, Senator Murkowski, actually walked off the floor not long after and said she was deeply insulted by the House comments. That's not a good strategy when you're trying to get them to vote for witnesses.
Margaret Taylor, what do you make of the presentation by the House managers? Like, for you, what's been the most compelling side of their argument?
So I think there is I think the most important thing that they have been doing is, as I said before, methodically walking through the facts, showing clips from the House impeachment proceedings, you know, just really making their argument based on facts and just walking through it. And they have to do that. They have the burden of proof, if you will, here. They have the burden to make their case that the president should be removed. So in some sense, what some senators are calling, you know, boring or repetitive, to my mind, that is something that just has to be done when you're, you know, prosecuting a case like this. I agree that that sort of moment in the middle of the night among both sides, actually, I think it was Jay Sekulow and Nadler, was not the brightest moment. But actually, I think the House managers have sort of recovered from that. They learned from it. And they've actually been, I think, remarkably sort of gracious and respectful of the Senate ever since that moment. So, you know, I think they have learned. I will be very anxious to see sort of going forward how, you know, their methodic walk through the facts contrast perhaps with what we might see from the president's defense team going forward. That's one thing I'm really curious to see and compare.
Well, we got a bit of a tease of that this week because the way the impeachment trial has been organized, we've heard almost exclusively from Democrats this week. But tomorrow, all the president's men get to make the case for the defense. So we got a preview of that from lead attorney Pat Cipollone on Tuesday. Let's have a listen.
We believe that once you hear those initial presentations, the only conclusion will be that the president has done absolutely nothing wrong.
Jonathan Turley, what do you expect to hear from the president's lawyers?
Well, one of the most surprising aspects is that the White House team built their defense around a highly contested theory that you require a crime to have an impeachable offense. And that is a position that many of us have rejected in the past. I testified on that very theory, not just in the Trump impeachment hearing, but also in the Clinton impeachment hearing. I don't believe that it is historically or legally accurate because it would essentially make impeachable synonymous with indictable. And what's really odd is that many of the Republican senators have said they don't agree with that theory. So you're going to be presenting that defense to a jury that's already said that they don't accept it. And that's what's a particularly odd move on their part.
Jonathan Turley, professor at George Washington University, and Margaret Taylor, senior editor at Lawfare, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
A new American novel is stirring up strong feelings. It's a story of migration to the U.S. Some have called it the grapes of wrath of our time. The protagonist is a Mexican mother running from drug cartel hitmen. The author is an American woman in New York City. The World's Jorge Valencia has a story.
The novel American Dirt was published to immediate acclaim. The back of the cover has quotes from the likes of Stephen King, and Latino celebrities posted about it on their social media.
It's a page-turner. Can't put it down.
This is writer and former NBC correspondent Mariana Atencio.
I think that anyone, especially someone with the prose of Janine Cummings, who humanizes our stories and tells the world that nobody leaves their home unless they absolutely have to, it deserves to be read, deserves to be heard.
Author Janine Cummings got a seven-figure deal with Flatiron Books for American Dirt, according to Publishers Weekly. In the novel, she tells the story of a woman named Lydia and her son Luca. They live in the southwest coast city of Acapulco, and the rest of their family is murdered by drug traffickers. Here's a line from the audiobook.
One of the very first bullets comes in through the open window above the toilet where Luca is standing.
The writing is gripping, and it's difficult to stop reading as each paragraph spills into the next. But many American writers of Latin American background quickly found the book problematic. The Mexican-American writer Miriam Gurba calls it a tourist version of what Mexico might look like.
The book is a collection of gross stereotypes intended to be consumed by a white audience with a sweet tooth for Mexican pain.
Gurba says Cummins also gets many cultural cues wrong. Take, for instance, the scene where the main character's family is violently killed. It's at what in Mexico would typically be a fancy coming-of-age party for a teenage girl. In the book, it's depicted as a cookout where the father grills the steaks.
The bent spatula sits in a puddle of congealed blood, and the flat part still bears a smudge of uncooked meat.
The description sounds like a casual American backyard gathering, not like a quinceañera, which is formal and which you put a great deal of effort into making elegant.
Janine Cummins has defended her book by saying she did 5 years worth of research for it. Her goal, she says, was to humanize migrants by presenting their stories in an intimate way. Critics say she didn't achieve that goal because of what she got wrong. But in Mexico, it's not new to see outsiders misrepresent the reality of the country. David Miklos is a novelist and founder of a literary review in Mexico City.
No tengo ningún problema en que se haga ficción sobre temas actuales.
Miklos says he has no problem with fiction about current events in Mexico. He says what troubles him is that American Dirt doesn't touch on the most important human rights issues facing migrants today.
O sea, donde tenemos que estar es en las políticas migratorias que está pasando en México. ¿Por qué?
Miklos says what we really need to be talking about are Mexico's migration policies and how the Trump administration has influenced them. For that kind of conversation to take place, writer Miriam Gurba says it would help to have greater diversity in book publishing. Roughly 80% of the people in it are white, according to a survey conducted 5 years ago by Lee and Lowe Books. Gurba says she does believe an outsider can successfully write about a community other than their own, but the underrepresentation of Latinos means books like American Dirt can get published with cultural inaccuracies.
They got played. Had there been Mexicans around, they wouldn't have gotten fooled. They don't trust us.
Gurba and many others who have joined the conversation are calling for a transformation of the book publishing industry. That way, as Gurba says, books will be more authentic than store-bought taco seasoning. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. People in the Carolinas with connections to Gullah know the expression ranky-tanky. It loosely means get funky, and that's what the band Ranky Tanky does on their Grammy-nominated album, Good Time. Now that you've heard what Ranky Tanky sounds like, you may be scratching your head about that word I dropped a moment ago, Gullah. What and who are Gullah? Let me orient you first. They are the descendants of enslaved Africans residing along the coast between North Carolina and Georgia. The heart of their culture is centered on the barrier islands of those states. To talk about Gullah, who better than Ranky Tanky? Band leader and guitarist Clay Ross, along with the group's bass player Kevin Hamilton, joined us in Boston. Here's Kevin.
There's different theories about the actual term. In one camp, they would say that descendants from Angola. But then also, there's a tribe called the Gullah that was also like speculated to be the origin of the slaves that came over from Africa.
And this is Clay Ross.
Yeah, Gullah is essentially the music and culture, the way of life of the descendants of formerly enslaved Africans in America. So it's a very unique and distinct African-American culture and African diaspora culture in the Americas. And because of the relative isolation of the islands, the culture has really survived and thrived in a very distinct way.
So would you say that Ranky Tanky has as its first kind of goal preserving Gullah culture, or is it just kind of a byproduct of what you're doing?
A little bit of both, I think, because, like, you know, there is a thing when Clay brought the idea to the band, there was a part of it where it was conscious and unconscious. You know, we were going to do what we're going to do anyway, because we were like, you know, that's how we play and that's how we interact. But at the same time, though, you know, he was like, it became a mission once we saw the reaction of people and how we also just people's wanting to share their stories with us. So it was like it was kind of hand in hand, I guess, the best answer I can give.
Yeah. I also think that there is an inherent integrity. So I think it is going to happen by default that we're going to honor this music and the culture of the descendants that are in this band with integrity. And even as close as I am to it, as a disciple of the music and not a descendant of the culture, I brush up against it sometimes, and I'm find myself, you know, sort of maybe offering some ideas that aren't okay with everybody.
Mm. Kevin, do you have Gullah roots?
I do. There's a part of Charleston called Huge and Cane Hoy, and that's a pretty thick Gullah community within the area. But the running joke in the band is actually that while I have that background, I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a part of it where, like, when I play and interact with other guys in the band, like Quentin and Charlton, you know, I get it. We have a connection that way. But I wasn't necessarily raised with all of the songs and the hymns. I heard it more like secondhand through other sources, but I didn't go to church that way.
Right. And so the music that you play today, is there anything in there that you kind of can refer back to from your childhood? Or is your background so kind of dispersed that it's kind of hard to pin things down?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I find like take a tune like Stand By Me, the clap, the actual rhythm, the accents. It's almost like a vernacular, even speech, with talking to my grandmother or something, you know, and there's just a certain rhythm to it.
I know that you'll be there for me. I know you'll be my eyes to see. Forever find me faithfully, thankfully, thankfully.
So Stand By Me, that's a tune that you often perform. Take us even further back, because it might be hard to hear kind of similarities between Stand By Me and songs from West Africa. But have you ever done like a side-by-side comparison between traditional Gullah music and, say, cultures from West Africa, their music, like in Sierra Leone or Angola, which is more Central Africa? I mean, do you hear anything in there?
Big time. I mean, honestly, that's what brought me to the idea of wanting to do this project. It was, you know, a journey. It's this huge, circuitous journey in my life in music. And when Quentin and I play these rhythms, it and Kevin, it's like a wonderful synergy happens. It's beautiful.
So we don't have the drums, but we do have Kevin. You're the bass player and you're a guitarist. But I'm wondering if there's some kind of percussive a cappella thing that you could do just to illustrate kind of the most basic kind of rhythm that might connect us back to
the African continent.
Yeah, and I think the core rhythm that you'll hear, and you hear this in so many cultures. You hear it in, you know, Argentinian tango. You hear it in Brazilian baião. You hear it in music in Morocco as well, all the way in the Far East. And it's just a simple syncopated beat. It goes like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, like this. And, you know, you could hear a Brazilian song, a style of music called Coco from Brazil. Mm-hmm. And you go, a vida tava tão boa, pra que mando me chamar? Vida tava tão boa, pra que mando me chamar? So that's the same as pain in my head, rinky-tanky. Pain in my heart, rinky-tanky. Pain in my feet, rinky-tanky. You know, it's a shared human language.
That's fantastic. So I've just learned that Ranky Tanky Day in Charleston is official. It's a thing. It's December, what, 17th?
Yeah.
December 17th, yeah.
I
also saw that both of you are graduates of the College of Charleston, as well as Quentin Baxter. They're pretty chuffed by your Grammy nomination. Mm-hmm. I know you're both New Yorkers now, but what is it like when Ranky Tanky plays in Charleston? Do you get a lot of people from the Gullah community turning out, and what's that scene all about?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, it gets to a point to where we can't have enough shows, really. I mean, on one side, you have an older crowd, people that are who were just into cultural arts, that kind of thing. But also, we played recently High Water Festival, and it was a huge young crowd, and they were just as enthusiastic. So it's a pretty varied affair.
Kevin Hamilton and Clay Ross from Ranky Tanky, thanks so much. Good luck to you, and it's great to see all the success for you guys.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks
We're
a
big
lot.
Fans, man. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
When a dark mind creeps up on me like a coward in the night.
Kevin Hamilton and Clay Ross of the band Ranky Tanky. Their album Good Time is nominated for a Grammy in the Regional Roots category. If you want more of the band and their music videos, come to theworld.org. A Canadian court is deciding whether to extradite a Chinese executive to the U.S. Meanwhile, China is detaining two Canadians. Some Canadians say, make a swap.
The Americans, frankly, have got us into this mess. And I think, frankly, if the shoe were on the other foot, the United States government would do exactly what I'm proposing.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH and PRX. A new kind of virus has prompted a stunning response from China. The movement of millions of people there has been halted. Developments with this new coronavirus are evolving minute by minute. Hundreds of people have been infected, mostly in China. During Chinese Central Television's Lunar New Year Gala special, one anchor said, "If we are united together, there is no obstacle we can't overcome." A message of unity for sure, but the tightly controlled Chinese media are showing signs of splintering. Xiaoying Feng is a U.S.-based correspondent with the BBC's Chinese service. She's been monitoring the press there and has noticed a divergence of views being expressed.
When I opened Weibo, which is the equivalent of Twitter in China this morning, I noticed that there are two main kinds of messages online. On one hand, there are many distressing videos and posts about the coronavirus. People are complaining that the hospitals are overloaded. Even people with symptoms, when they go to the hospitals, they are turned away because there's simply no beds for them. Mm. And on the other hand, there are colorful images from this New Year gala. which is broadcast by the state broadcaster CCTV to celebrate the Lunar New Year, which is this Saturday. And it's important to know that the show did add a segment addressing the coronavirus, which we just heard. It's a unified message. One of the anchors said, do not write anything that would upset the Wuhan people because they're making all this sacrifice. And of course, these are indications for a propaganda effort to say, oh, we are a unified country. We can do this together. There's nothing we can't overcome.
So when this virus was first detected, how public was the conversation? Was it an open discussion in Chinese media?
When the outbreak first happened, a lot of information about the virus was controlled by the government. You could notice the censorship because there was not a large amount of information available on the internet at the time. But there's a tipping point which came around 20th of January. If you look at Baidu, which is the Chinese equivalent to Google, a search engine, you notice a spike of surge of coronavirus or Wuhan virus after 20th of January. That's the time when the government loosened its censorship on the outbreak. So we're seeing a very vibrant Chinese media scene. Many media outlets are pushing the boundary to cover the story, sending reporters on the ground. And actually, Chinese language media have been way ahead of many international media outlets.
What was the Chinese central government's thinking when they loosened those censorship restrictions?
My guess is that the government might have learned a lesson from SARS, thinking that it's time to let people get some information that would help with preventing the virus from further spreading.
Does it provide you something of a test, or at least kind of like an image of what open media, free expression in China might look like?
I mean, for decades, the country suffered from lack of freedom of speech, lack of freedom of press. And now with this loosened censorship, although there's still propaganda efforts and still controlled, you get a glimpse of what China would look like and what Chinese press can do in terms of covering a crisis like this.
What do you think it would take for this kind of attitude, this posture in China to stick?
Well, it's really tricky, right? On one hand, the government wants to inform people of the right information regarding the outbreak to prevent it from worsening. On the other hand, more critical information about the government becoming available online and on Chinese press will also jeopardize the authorities' status. So it's a tricky balance, and I would not expect the censorship to continue to be loosened for a long time, maybe not on other topics that might create dangers for the government. But at the moment, we are enjoying the limited freedom we get right now regarding the less censorship on the outbreak.
Yeah, Chenamen and Winnie the Pooh, which is often code for Xi Jinping, still no-go topics, right?
No, I would not go that far.
Chao Yingfeng is a correspondent with the BBC's Chinese service. Thanks very much for unpacking this for us.
Thank you.
China is walking another tightrope, dealing with a potential prisoner swap. You may have heard of Meng Wanzhou, a top executive with the Chinese telecom giant Huawei. A Canadian judge is now deciding whether to extradite her to the U.S. The U.S. wants Meng for allegedly evading sanctions on Iran. Meanwhile, Beijing is detaining two Canadians, accusing them of espionage. Their detention is widely seen as retaliation and as a bargaining chip. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has that story.
All three people were arrested about a year ago, but their situations are very different. Meng Wanzhou is under house arrest in her Vancouver mansion, but she's not confined there. Meng can move around the city as long as she's wearing an ankle monitor, which she likes to pair with Jimmy Choo stilettos for court appearances. She has time for reading, oil painting, and long phone calls. The two Canadians being held in Chinese detention don't have it so good. Their names are Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. They're also known in the Canadian media as the two Michaels. Rob Malley is Michael Kovrig's boss at the International Crisis Group.
If Michael could live under even, you know, a slice of what Ms. Meng gets, he would be, as his family would be, enormously grateful.
Malley says it doesn't take a political science degree to see what's going on here. Kovrig, he says, was arrested in China just over a week after Meng was detained in Canada.
She's out on bail, living in luxury place, is able to move around. He's not. He is confined. He doesn't have much contact with the outside world. He doesn't even know what are the charges that are being brought against him. And it's obviously taken a physical and mental toll.
In recent weeks, several prominent Canadians have been calling for a prisoner swap. Canada would release Meng, and China would free the two Michaels. Edward Goldenberg is a former chief of staff to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and a partner in the law firm Bennett Jones.
The first priority of any government must be the liberty of its citizens.
Goldenberg says Canada should do what is necessary, and if that means snubbing the Americans by not extraditing Meng Wanzhou, then so be it.
The Americans, frankly, have got us into this mess. And I think if the shoe were on the other foot, the United States government would do exactly what I'm proposing.
Goldenberg suspects, and he's not alone, that the Trump administration sees Meng Wanzhou as a pawn in the U.S.-China trade war. Trump himself tweeted that he would intervene in her case if it might help trade talks with China. Goldenberg says the arrest warrant and extradition request for Meng appear to be politically motivated.
The United States administration is doing this as a part of their geopolitical struggle against China. And you can agree or disagree with their political position, but I think it's put Canada between a rock and a hard place. And to use an expression that I think is well known in the United States, instead of saying America first, I would say Canada first.
But Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is proceeding with caution. He rejected the idea of a prisoner swap at a press conference this week. Trudeau said Canada would stand by its extradition treaties.
We're a country of the rule of law, and we will abide by the rule of law.
Trudeau might be wary of a possible backlash from Washington. But Margaret McQuaig-Johnston, a senior fellow at the University of Alberta's China Institute, says there's another reason why a prisoner swap would be a bad idea.
We can't have a situation where China learns that it can get what it wants on the world stage by kidnapping Canadians or kidnapping citizens of other countries.
She says China has been emboldened long enough.
They've kidnapped the citizens of Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Sweden, Australia, the U.S. So this is a tactic they regularly use, and somebody's got to stand up to them.
But there's something else. McQuaig-Johnston points out that most of the people calling for a prisoner swap come from the business community, whose bottom line has been hit hard by this international spat. Because in addition to detaining Canadian citizens, China also banned certain Canadian farm products. McQuaig-Johnston says the business community is eager to put all of this behind them.
I have a lot of respect for the people who are calling for a prisoner exchange. But I think they would like the relationship to go back to the way it was before so that business can get back on track, so we can continue to have collaborations. And I don't think that our relationship with China is ever going to go back to the way it was a year and a half ago.
China's detention of Kovrig and Spavor has brought up another question north of the border, and that is, what happened to Canada's most important global ally, the United States? Some Canadians are watching this story play out and feeling abandoned by the U.S. Last month, Trudeau asked Trump to hold off signing his Phase 1 trade deal with China until after the Michaels were released. Trump ignored that request and signed the trade deal anyway. As the editors at the Globe and Mail put it, Washington's abdication has left Canada high and dry. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Bologna in the north of Italy is known for its university and its food culture. It's also in a region of Italy that has been staunchly left-wing for 75 years. But now it and the country are on the brink of a political earthquake. The country's far-right party, the League, has been winning support across parts of northern Italy, and that could eventually turn control of the Italian government over to Matteo Salvini, the populist, anti-migrant face of the League. The BBC's Mark Lowen has our story from northern Italy.
Just arrived in Ferrara, a town in northern Italy,
that's been a bastion of the centre-left since the Second World War until last year when they voted in the far-right League Party of Matteo Salvini. And as soon as you get out of the station, the first part of the city goes a long way to explaining why. It's called GAD. It's a real problem area. Crime, migration, drug dealing. And the message of the League Party here was, give us control of Ferrara and we'll make this area safe again. Beneath the area's 1970s concrete skyscraper, I meet Nicola Lodi, Ferrara's new far-right deputy mayor, a brawny, tough talker, nicknamed the Sheriff.
We had to start to liberate this area from these Nigerians who were dealing drugs here illegally. This place was packed with drug dealers. Look at those dealers there. Come and see.
Sono scappati. Eccoli.
And they've just gone into the building. They've gone away. Non è razzista di pensare. Isn't it racist to assume the Nigerians are drug dealers, I ask?
Se andare vicino una persona.
If you go after someone and they flee, it's not racist. If they're escaping, it's because they have something to hide.
Buongiorno. Buongiorno. Lavoro. Buongiorno.
In central Ferrara, with its sublime Renaissance castle and cathedral, Nicola Lodi is campaigning to win Sunday's regional election. That would break 75 years of left-wing control here, possibly topple the government and sweep the far-right populist Matteo Salvini into power as Prime Minister.
Posso salutarti?
Dipende. Dipende chi è.
He stops off in the shop of Cristina Perdonati, where the message resonates. The migrants bring illnesses, she says. I have nothing against the people who come here, but Italians must come first.
Prima gli italiani.
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
What's your name?
Rosalyn.
But for migrants like Rosalyn, the new hardline council sows fear. What's happening to Italy? What's happening to this city?
To me, I can't say. I don't know what is happening right now. Maybe they don't want the foreigners. The new party now, we're looking for reasons to close shops. So for 2 months, my shop was closed down. It makes me feel I'm intimidated. Sometimes my child used to ask me, Mommy, why is it that the police always come? I said, I don't know.
Near Ferrara, they're preparing for a Salvini rally, the square filling up. This region is one of Italy's wealthiest. Unemployment is half the national average. But an ageing population has struggled to accept migrants, and many here are frustrated with stasis and Italy's economic stagnation.
Italiani orgogliosi di essere italiani.
The rock star of Italian politics charms the crowd with his line, security, migration, change. Haven't you created a fear of the other, I ask him?
No. If people are fearful, it's not because Salvini tells them through the BBC that they should be afraid. If crime is on the rise, it's a problem. But we don't only speak about security, we also tell people about the economy, jobs, pensions and schools.
And I ask, what about those who say the League is racist and fascist?
I'm the least racist person in the world.
Not absolutely everybody on this square supports Salvini. There are a few opponents of him over here. Let's just go and talk to them.
What it stands for, hate and discrimination, it's not what we want. We passed this thoughts 70 years ago when the war ended and where Mussolini died.
Back in Ferrara Old Town, a pianist serenades beneath the spires, a scene out of Italy's Dolce Vita. And yet this country feels politically lost, swinging between extremes in a constant identity crisis. This Sunday could be a turning point. If the far right wins here, they could win across Italy and drag Europe to a new beat.
The BBC's Mark Lowen reporting there from northern Italy. Tomorrow, January 25th, marks 9 years since Egyptians took to the streets to overthrow a dictator. The Tahrir Square revolution successfully ousted Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. But since 2011, Egypt has struggled through multiple leaders, a coup, and crackdowns on free speech. Musician Rami Esam and visual artist Ganzir know that better than most. They were two of the most influential artists for protesters 9 years ago in Egypt. Now both of them live in exile, but their work still packs a punch.
Rami Essam and Ganzir are teaming up to commemorate the Egyptian Revolution tomorrow in New York City. It will be a night of music, commentary, and visual arts celebrating the younger generation of Egyptians that led the protests and the ongoing struggles.
Basically, the whole tour is beyond resistance. And then on January 25th is Tahrir and Beyond. And that's a one-day event. That is basically where I'll be involved, going on stage and doing an audiovisual performance, giving a bit of a talk and showing some of the visual art that went into the uprising 9 years ago. Obviously, Rami is the audio component. That's kind of the climax of Rami's tour.
What do you want people who see it to get out of it, Rami?
My main goal was everything I'm trying to do as an artist, especially in a day like that, is really to remind the people that it's not over, because it's getting so hard in Egypt, and maybe I have a better chance being outside Egypt at the moment, and I want to do my best to give this hope to people and to remind everybody that the story didn't end. We're still fighting, even if it's in different form, in different places, in different ways.
I mean, it has been 9 years, as you say, and the Egyptian uprising that began at Tahrir ultimately did not achieve what the protesters wanted, which was true democracy. So as you look back at what's happened since the Tahrir Square protests, how do you both feel?
You know, obviously there's a bit of trauma and depression to deal with, but I think these performances are like an awesome way for us to deal with them our way, because based on like last week's performance alone, just the energy in the bar, it was nuts, you know, and all these people, there was a big Egyptian diaspora presence, and a lot of them were people that I met through different events prior, and I could tell the difference, you know. There was like, I met them before and I could tell that they were depressed having been here for a while and kind of been away from Egypt and the way things had gone. And last week, it was like relighting the spark all over again. The other thing is, one of the anthems of the Lebanese uprising right now on the front line, someone shared a video with me on Twitter where protesters are kind of facing off with police. And they took with them a bunch of speakers and were playing one of Rami's songs. Not one of the songs from like way back from 2011, but one of the songs he put out while in Sweden, which I think is a testament to like, no, that you could still participate and kind of influence from a distance very powerfully.
So what you're doing sounds like it's helping Egyptian expats anyway. How does music and art help you two reconcile that incomplete revolution?
I'm always taking my music as my therapy and as my first friend. Sometimes I don't find anybody else but this friend with me. And when I was saying I want to share hope with people through my music, I'm helping myself as well. Sometimes I play guitar to myself to lift my spirit up. So it's a big, big reason why I'm still hanging around in this life.
Both of you, Ganzir and Rami, you both live in exile from your native Egypt. If you lived in Egypt, would any of your work be possible? Could you commemorate Tahrir as a multimedia project?
Oh, no way.
Definitely not. Which is why this event is so important. The state of Egypt, the current dictatorship, has kind of controlled the narrative, post-revolution narrative, for a very long time and has poisoned that narrative very much. And there's a lot of anti-revolution propaganda. And by forcing us into exile, they think they have rendered us powerless. But I think having an event like this shows that, you know, even in exile, we're going to keep the spirit going.
So it allows you to flex your artistic and kind of political muscle. But I'm curious why you do this if ultimately it's art that Egyptians in the center of these political problems can't see.
Okay, we are talking about art. And art is like the strongest peaceful weapon we could use against dictatorship. If we are in Egypt or not, like Ganzir mentioned before, we can still release a song and it can make huge impact even in the whole region. I've been experiencing that a lot when I'm in exile. Same thing to Ganzir. When the movement in Egypt just a couple of months ago was trying to rise up again, and he made just like a new artwork for the dictator, and people were using it all over the world. So we know that we can still help for making any kind of change with our art. We learned very well that the change won't happen in one day, and we started something in 2011, and we won't stop. I have lots of things that will keep me doing what I'm doing, either from the early dreams we've been carrying from 2011 or all the friends that are in jail at the moment, they have to know that we're still fighting for them and for the same cause.
Beyond Resistance becomes Beyond Tahrir on January 25th at National Sawdust in Brooklyn. Rami Assam and Ganzir, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having us, dude.
Thank you.
The Australian Open is in full swing right now in Melbourne. Today, one player stole the spotlight, Coco Gauff.
What a brilliant set of tennis by the 15-year-old.
Coco Gauff, the 15-year-old American tennis phenom from Florida. She's ranked number 67 in the world. Today she faced off against last year's Australian Open winner, the world's number 4, Naomi Osaka of Japan. Coco pulled off a stunning upset.
Remember the date. January 24, 2020.
Yeah, remember the date, January 24th. Coco handily beat Osaka in straight sets, knocking her from the tournament. It was the biggest win of Coco's young career. What a difference a few months make. Last August, Osaka crushed Coco in the U.S. Open. Right after today's match, Coco Gauff was smiling and waving to the crowd.
Honestly, like, what is my life? Like, oh my gosh. Two years ago, I lost first round in juniors, and now I'm here. Like, this is crazy.
At 15, Coco is the youngest player competing in the tournament, and that means she's still got some teenage responsibilities.
Is there more homework later or tomorrow?
Yes, probably tomorrow because I want to go to sleep tonight. But my teachers, they're giving me some time because considering the circumstances, they're letting me submit some assignments late, so that's okay.
They sound very nice, your teachers.
I'm guessing she's going to ace it. Tomorrow, Coco Gauff will face Sophia Kennan, another American. And if you've got some extra time this weekend, you can always channel surf between tennis and the impeachment trial, if that floats your boat. Whatever you opt for, make it a relaxing weekend. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.